Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. But stand by now for the World View. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to another exciting week on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And by original thought, I mean biblical thought. Christian thought, even. Just in case you weren't sure. I try to make that clear on every broadcast. And for those of you in the audience who are heathens, just keep listening. You may find yourself entertained anyways. And you might even think, you never know. Okay, I want to start with a commentary on the state of modern journalism. I'm watching Anderson Cooper 360, of course, as I always do, religiously. Got to get my AC every day. Anyway, there's a helicopter hovering over one of the outbuildings around the Fukushima reactor there in Japan, and Anderson makes the comment, there's smoke. There's smoke coming from the building. We think it's from a fire, but we just don't know. Anderson Cooper, like most journalists, just can't know anything. But Anderson, if there's smoke, I can assure you it's from a fire. You can know that, Anderson. There are many things you will never know, Mr. Cooper. But where there's smoke, there's fire, okay? So let's just clear that up for AC, our good buddy over there at CNN. Anyway, okay, I've got so much on my plate this week, I've just got to get right to it, I suppose. There's all this activity in the Middle East. Libya, what can I say about Libya? Folks, 3 weeks ago, when Barack Obama. I apologize to the memory of Saddam Hussein. When Obama dipped his pinky toe in the water regarding Libya and began to make grumblings that perhaps Muammar Gaddafi should consider thinking about the possibility of bringing in a committee to study stepping down. I forget exactly how Mr. Obama put it, but it was something like that. I must admit, I felt tempted to go on the air and say Obama will strike. That's what I was tempted to do because that's what my gut. I remembered back to the pirates. You remember the pirate that Obama shot off the fantail of the naval ship there? I mean, he didn't actually pull the trigger. I mean, he pulled the trigger in Washington, but actually there were some very competent Navy SEALs who pulled the trigger, but Obama did it. That day I knew that Barack Obama was different, significantly different than, say, Jimmy Carter. Barack Obama's genuinely dangerous. Because he will pull the trigger. But then over the next few days, I heard that Barack's pastor, the Right Reverend Wright, was a good friend of Gaddafi, and I got a bit convoluted. I just wasn't sure. I became confused and muddled, and I just wasn't sure what Obama would do. And this weekend, I believe he's done just that. I just don't know. I'm just not sure exactly what Barry Ho's plan is there in Libya. And I've read a bit about the goings-on. Do I want to do that now? I don't want to do that now. I'm going to get to that later, I think. I'll get to that later. It's a little late to make predictions, I suppose. But events are moving quickly there in the Libyan desert, the deserts of North Africa, where Patton proved his mettle against Erwin Rommel, and where our mettle will be tested, and the mettle of the free world and the not so free world, all of which are for bouncing Gaddafi out of power. But let's start in the Bronx. Bring it a little closer to home for you, folks. You all saw the dramatic pictures last week, if you were paying attention, of the tour bus, the casino tour bus that had It skidded into a light pole, and the light pole peeled the top off the bus like a can of sardines or something. It was bizarre to see the picture Well, listen to this, folks. Bernardo Garcia was on that bus. This is from the New York Post. He's a 50-year-old cook from Brooklyn. His buddy Miguel Aquino was one of 14 people killed in last Saturday's horrific 5:30 a.m. worldwide tour bus crash on the Hutchinson River Parkway. And he told the Post that after he survived the crash, he thought Lady Luck must be on his side. Another gentleman, Theodore Rodulescu, a 55-year-old cook from the Bronx, rushed straight from St. Barnabas Hospital after the accident, after surviving this horrific crash in which 15 other elderly gamblers were killed. He rushed straight from St. Barnabas Hospital, picked up new clothes before boarding another worldwide tour bus back to Connecticut's Mohegan Sun Casino, along with Bernardo Garcia. They went right back to the casino. Only hours earlier, according to the Post, the pair had been on the worldwide bus tour that careened out of control and had its top sheared off by a metal pole on the highway in the Bronx, decapitating at least one passenger and ripping the arms off other passengers. And they went back to the casino. Assuming Lady Luck must be smiling upon them. So that's just bizarre. And that's where we start. Bizarre in the Bronx, here on the Weekly Worldview, as we dive into another week that God has prepared for us. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to enjoy this week. Whether you live or die, you're going to enjoy this week. Because, well, I shouldn't say you're going to enjoy this week. You're going to experience this week, whether you break the surly bonds of earth or not, because we are eternal beings. God put that in us. And we will either live forever, or you will merely exist forever. But you are eternal, so make preparations for the destination of your eternal soul. And I can assure you, it's not the Mohegan Sun in Connecticut, no matter which way it breaks down. All right, now let's go to the war. This will probably give me a chance to come back to my rather muddled thinking on this entire Libyan adventure that we seem to have gotten ourselves into. Let's start in Jerusalem. We've been covering the horrible story of the Fogel family butchered in their home by someone. I've got a story from WorldNet Daily, Dateline Jerusalem. Two members of a Palestinian Authority, President Mahmoud Abbas, official security forces, were arrested in conjunction with the bloody massacre in which five members of the Fogel family were brutally stabbed to death inside their home in the Jewish village of Itamar. Two cousins are now in Israeli custody and are suspected in the slayings. Ahmed Awad is an officer in President Abbas's preventive security services, and Iyad Awad, is an officer in Mahmoud Abbas's General Intelligence Service in Ramallah. According to WorldNet Daily, both the preventative and general intelligence services of Fatah are armed, trained, and funded by the United States of America. Your tax dollars and mine, ladies and gentlemen, went to pay the salaries of these two cousins. Now, the two cousins, according to WorldNet Daily, did not personally carry out the murders, but they assisted in the planning and logistics of the slaughter of the Fogel family in the occupied territory, which in America we call those suburbs. Again, from WorldNet Daily, since the late 1990s, the U.S. has run training bases for Palestinian Authority militias. The U.S. has also provided hundreds of millions of dollars in financial aid and weapons to build up the PA militia. Since 2007, the U.S. has stepped up its efforts at training the PA, including a new advanced program for Palestinian police to train 500 to 600 cadets at a time right here in America on American bases. The U.S. currently operates training bases for the PA police and other militias such as Force 17 and the Preventative Security Service, for whom Ahmed Awad, planner of the butchering of the Fogel family, worked. Are we funding the wrong side? Are we on the wrong side of history? That's a popular term these days. I think Barry Ho came out and said he thought Gaddafi was on the wrong side of history. Well, Mr. Obama, you may want to start seeing which side of history we're on. Because this is not a side I want to be on. Funding militias that butcher families in their outpost settlements, better known as the suburbs of Jerusalem. Awful. All right, more from the war. Okay, some encouraging news from the war. I know, the war gets me down, it gets you down. It's a long war. In fact, it may be our longest war so far. So it gets us down, but let's get a little bit of good news from the Telegraph in London. In late August 2009, Sergeant Tom Potter and Rifleman Mark Osmond marked the start of an astonishing episode in the history of British Army sniping. Within 40 days of August 2009, the two marksmen from four rifles, the company Four Rifles, part of the Welsh Guards battle group, had achieved 75 confirmed kills. That's pretty impressive. I mean, I'm no expert on sniping, but 75 confirmed kills in 40 days, I mean, that is a rather efficient expending of ammunition for these two gentlemen. According to the Telegraph, on one occasion, they killed 8 Taliban in 2 hours. Osmond says, quote, "I wasn't comfortable with it at first. You start wondering, is it really necessary? But the reaction of the locals soon persuaded him." He says, quote, "We had people coming up to us afterwards, not scared to talk to us. They finally felt like they were being protected." Now, on September 12th, a known Taliban commander appeared on the back of a motorcycle with another passenger. Taking deliberate aim, Osmond fired a single shot. The bike tumbled, and both men fell onto the road and lay there motionless. When the British patrol returned, they checked the men and confirmed they were both dead with large holes through their heads. The 7.62-millimeter bullet Osmond had fired had passed through the heads of both men. He had achieved the rare feat of one shot, two kills. It just gives me a good feeling to read that. Now, this one shot, two kills is known in the sniping business as a Quigley. Yes, a Quigley. The term comes from the 1990 film Quigley Down Under, in which you'll remember Tom Selleck played Quigley, and he used an old Sharps rifle. So congratulations to Sergeant Tom Potter and Rifleman Mark Osmond, and particularly Mr. Osmond. Congratulations on that Quigley, my friend. Outstanding news from the war. But still, the war does not go well. Unfortunately, Osmond and his compatriot, Sergeant Potter, are not able to kill all the Taliban all the time. And so the war drags on. And the uprisings continue there in the Middle East. I've got a story from, I don't know where this story is from. It's from the Canadian version of the Associated Press, I think. Anyways, thousands of Iranians marched last Friday in Tehran, Iran, in support of the results, rocking Bahrain, Libya, and Yemen. Chants backing the protests of majority Shiites in Bahrain, who are challenging the Sunni dynasty's grip on power, dominated the demonstration, which unfolded in the capital of Tehran after the ever-popular Friday Muslim prayers. The Saudis are committing crimes and the U.S. supports them, was one of the chants. And the other two chants that were the most popular, you guessed it, death to America and death to Israel. Great signs from the Arab street there in the Middle East. Slogans in support of the rebellion in Libya and protests in Yemen also rang out throughout the day. And according to the AP Canada, Ayatollah Ahmed Janati, hardline cleric and head of the powerful Guardians Council there in Iran, condemned the dispatch of Saudi troops to Bahrain after the ever-popular Friday Muslim prayers. He also called on Libyan rebels to pursue their struggle, yada, yada, yada. And so the less than moderate Muslim element continues to encourage their brethren in rebellion. And what do we have going on? Do I have another war story? Should I do? Okay, the Saudi king, I'll do this quickly. The Saudi king, in a rare televised address, according to CNN, In a rare televised address, Saudi King Abdullah made a brief statement congratulating Saudis for their loyalty and national unity. Amongst a wave of new spending, the decrees outlined a boost in welfare benefits, bonuses for public sector workers, including the army, and a massive drive to build new housing. In addition, the king ordered the creation of 60,000 security jobs within the Interior Ministry and promised more money for the religious police, the ever-popular religious police there in Saudi Arabia. So taking a cue from the folks who put Barry Ho into power back there in Chicago, when there's trouble in the streets, start handing money around. Start creating patronage jobs. So obviously King Abdullah has been paying attention to Mr. Daley, Mr. Obama, and of course the ever-popular Rahm Emanuel back in Chicago, and they've learned their message, they've learned their lesson well, because they're in a bit of trouble because they've sent 1,000 troops to neighboring Bahrain to help contain the alleged pro-democracy protests. And the CNBC article tells us that with more than $400 billion in foreign reserves, Saudi Arabia is in a more comfortable position than many neighbors to alleviate social pressures such as high youth unemployment. Who knows, folks, by the summer, half the youth in Saudi Arabia could be working for the government of the city of Chicago. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. That guitar solo just really isn't good enough to let it roll. I dig the tune, don't get me wrong. Like, that part's cool, but the guitar solo's just too weak. But back to the war, folks. Right. My meandering thoughts on early to mid-90s pop aside. Let's get back to the war. I read the headline on the internet that the United States has opened a third front in the Middle East. And indeed, it is a third front in the Middle East. And folks are questioning the wisdom of doing so. I want to remind everyone that actually we have a fifth front. Okay, because we have an Asian front, about 50,000 or more troops in Asia. We have a European front, I think at least 50,000 troops still in Germany and those parts. And then, of course, we've got Iraq, we've got Afghanistan, and now we have Libya, so we have five fronts. But the other four fronts, they're either cold or they're unconventional. So I wouldn't say opening another front is necessarily wrong or doomed to failure. I mean, if you listen to this broadcast, you know that I've supported opening a front in Iran as soon as possible ever since 2001. Actually, ever since 1979, frankly. So these other fronts that are in which we're involved, they're not the traditional World War II where you have soldiers with uniforms on one side against soldiers in uniform on the other side. And certainly we can't equate what's happening today in this unconventional asymmetrical warfare with wars of the past. But don't you think it might be wise for us to resolve at least one of the other four before we open a fifth? That's all I'm saying. And I mean, folks, for the first time here, we have a chance for an actual conventional war where troops land on the beach and fight against the troops of another power and ally with the rebels and take cities and knock out infrastructure and kill the enemy and capture and declare... declare war. How about that? Here's an opportunity where we could have had an official declaration of war against the state of Libya in conjunction with our allies. We could go in and we could dispose of this dictator in short order and like that. But we haven't. We've decided not to do that. And like I said, I don't know what Obama was going to do, and apparently he's done just that. And We're launching missiles, and apparently it's the French who've decided they're going to put their pilots over Libya and perhaps even their troops on the ground in Libya. I mean, I can just hear the conversation between the French Minister of Defense and, you know, in between cigars and prostitutes, he catches Nicolas Sarkozy in the hallway. Monsieur Sarkozy, it is Libya. Surely we must go. We could even win. This is Libya. And Mr. Sarkozy apparently acceded to that. So, folks, you know, last week I talked about when you have a band of Libyan rebels fighting Libyan military, never in history has so much ammunition been expended with so few casualties inflicted. But now we've got the French landing on the scene, and they could challenge that record. Should be an interesting couple of weeks in Libya. And, of course, the two-week campaign that it should take to kill or capture Muammar Gaddafi is just the beginning. Because I guess that's the way we do things now. And there'll be no declaration of war, which is unfortunate because it would be nice to have just a regular old war again. You know, I hate to sound like I'm longing for the old days of conventional conflict, but these unconventional asymmetrical conflicts, they wear on my nerves. And it would be nice to see our troops roll through El Alamein once and head to Tripoli, and then it's over. And it would just be better than what I've been seeing. All right. Let's see. Now let's move into the politics file. Is that all I have on the war? I guess that's all I have, folks. To me, if you listen to this broadcast, you realize that the typical stories of the day that people follow are not necessarily the stories that I follow. Because I like to focus on the actual, credible threat against you and your family and your security and your safety and your spirituality. And that threat typically comes from closer to home. Case in point, from NBC in New York, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani appeared in New Hampshire last Friday, and he gave little hint of his plans, but seemed relaxed during a showy speech that was laced with jokes and hand gestures as he skewered Obama as a failure and ended with the declaration, Hillary Clinton would have been better, as his false teeth popped out of his mouth. That's what I've been waiting to see with Giuliani. You know, you remember Fire Marshal Bill from the old Wayans Brothers TV show? Giuliani reminds me of Fire Marshal Bill, and I always think that with that tight, clenched jaw that those false teeth are just going to pop out one of these days. And he'll be revealed for the alien life form that he actually is. Anyway, so he says Hillary Clinton would have been better. That sounds very Rudy-esque. Giuliani lauded the Tea Party movement extensively, saying that it's about preserving the freedoms of the country. Mr. Giuliani, just get out. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry. I mean, it's just, unless you're some kind of egomaniac, there's just no point. Please spare us, Mr. Giuliani. Leave it to Mitt Romney to be the ultimate embarrassment in the 2012 election cycle and just go sell books or do whatever it is you do. Marry women 40 years younger than you, cheat on her. I'm not saying that's what Rudy's doing. I know the type. Let me just put it that way. All right. So, Rudy, just get out, please. More from the politics file. This is from the Reuters Wire. Speaking of closer to home, this is in Montana. Police raids last month capped an 18-month investigation of marijuana trafficking in Montana. That's right. The raids and the sweep prompted an outcry from the medical marijuana advocates who accused the government of cracking down on growers and distributors who were operating legally under Montana's 7-year-old medical marijuana law. Yes. So the medical professionals in the medical community in Montana are outraged that their dispensing of medicine is being looked at askew by the federal government with suspicions that perhaps they're dope dealers. Well, the medical professionals and the doctors in Montana are offended. And according to the article from Reuters, although cannabis, that's what they call marijuana in Europe, I think, although cannabis is still considered an illegal narcotic under federal law, 15 states in the District of Columbia have statutes legalizing pot for medical use. So that's interesting juxtaposition of facts to me, folks, because I think in a later story, oh, here we go. So the states are allowed peacefully without any disruption from their very little disruption from the federal government to write their own laws about drugs that are blatantly in violation of federal laws regarding drugs. But if you threaten to coin your own currency, you're called a terrorist. Yes. And I'm not saying printing fake money. I'm talking about coining currency. In fact, let's get to that story here before the next break. More from the politics file from Raleigh, North Carolina. State Representative Glenn Bradley wants North Carolina to issue its own legal tender backed by silver or gold. The Republican from Youngsville, South Carolina, or is it North Carolina? Where's Raleigh? Somebody help me out here. Raleigh, North Carolina? Raleigh, South Carolina? They both sound right. I just don't know. Well, it's probably here in the store. Oh, North Carolina. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize. A little bit distracted there. Okay, it's North Carolina. The Republican from Youngsville, North Carolina, has introduced a bill that would establish a legislative commission to study his plan for a state currency. He's also drafting a second bill that would require state government to accept gold and silver coins as payment for taxes and fees. That's what the Republican there from Glenn Bradley, who introduced this bill, that's his position. Mike Walden, an economics professor at North Carolina State University, said the notion of North Carolina reverting to having its own currency is outlandish. It's outlandish, he says. And he's an economics professor at the North Carolina State University. So he's saying that this other fellow is crazy, which is often the tact of the delusional left, is to call common sense ideas outlandish, crazy, stupid, kooky, conspiratorial, all that. Walden, the professor, he says, we dealt with this issue about 100 years ago when the Federal Reserve was established. If North Carolina were to have its own currency, that would put us at an extreme competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis other parts of the country and other parts of the world. Is that right, Mr. Walden? Having a currency that actually has value would put you at a disadvantage? Well, that possibly could be true since the other side is basically counterfeiting and can just print as much as they want. So I might actually agree with him there, but quite often doing the right thing puts one at a competitive disadvantage. Well, you know, when you're not lying and stealing and counterfeiting, you could be at a slight business disadvantage, but is that necessarily such a bad thing? Representative Glenn Bradley, who introduced the bill, he predicts that world events could soon prove him to be quite prescient in his ideas about currency. And folks, I don't know where I come down on the gold standard. I'm convinced that there should be some standard. It can't just be smoke and mirrors and wind blowing up the skirts of the bond buyers around the world. I just don't think that should be the standard. And that brings us to Statesville, North Carolina. Bernard von Nuthaus, a 67-year-old American in Statesville, North Carolina, was convicted last week by a federal jury of making, possessing, and selling his own coins. Talk about a terroristic crime. Following an 8-day trial and less than 2 hours of deliberation, von Nuthaus, the founder and monetary architect of a currency known as the Liberty Dollar, was found guilty by a jury there in Statesville, North Carolina, of making coins resembling and similar to United States coins. So, yes, they were similar, except they had actual value because they were made of silver. So that was one, not to put too fine a point on it, not to split hairs, but his coins actually had intrinsic value, whereas the coins he was mimicking of the United States are, you know, basically zinc plugs that are worth whatever you and I are told they're worth. Now, this is straight from the FBI website, by the way. According to the evidence introduced during the trial, von Nuthaus was the founder of an organization called the National Organization for the Repeal of the Federal Reserve and Internal Revenue Code, commonly known as NORFED, also known as Liberty Services. Since 1998, NorFed has been issuing, disseminating, and placing into circulation the Liberty Dollar in all its forms throughout the United States and Puerto Rico. NorFed intended for the Liberty Dollar to compete with United States currency, and the counterfeiters up at the Fed will have none of that. They certainly don't want any competition. Von Nathaus faces a sentence of up to 15 years imprisonment and a fine of not more than $250,000. In addition, the United States is seeking the forfeiture of approximately 16,000 pounds of Liberty Dollar coins and precious metals in the possession of Mr. Von Nathaus, currently valued at nearly $7 million. So they're trying to confiscate the guy's coins, and they're worth $7 million, which is kind of funny because they say that it's counterfeit, but then they say it's worth $7 million. Well, which is it? Counterfeit money isn't worth anything. This guy's got $7 million worth of money, and the government wants it. It's one of the ways they might be able to plug a budget shortfall there in the FBI is to confiscate this poor guy's silver. Anyway, the FBI concludes their report with the following statement, quote, Attempts to undermine the legitimate currency of this country are simply a unique form of domestic terrorism. Terrorism indeed, Mr. U.S. Attorney. If that's the case, under the Patriot Act, I think we should arrest all of Congress. So, folks, I don't know what the standard should be. I don't know if there should be a gold standard. I don't know if there should be a silver standard. Maybe there should be a silica standard. Maybe we should make the standard of money something that's plentiful. Maybe there should be a hydrogen standard. But I'm convinced, based on what I see happening around me, and just common sense, that the value of a nation's money should have a foundation of something real and something of intrinsic value. Perhaps we should have a dirt standard. All of the land in the United States, let's figure out what it's all worth and let's base our monetary system on that so that we can't just get ridiculous and stupid. There has to be some limitation on how much money the government can coin, and I'm not so sure that the government is necessarily the place where currency should be coined. Perhaps it should be... Perhaps currency and the exchange of goods and services should be a private matter between citizens. And the government could certainly have some standards that if you're going to pay the government, you have to use this or that. But as far as me and my neighbor bartering and trading goods and services, we should be able to decide upon our own currency, I do believe. And I used to not be of that persuasion. But I don't know. I joined Groupon. And so now I see the light. Anyway, I just found out how that works. And I'll tell you what, Groupon really takes a lot of the money on that. I don't know if I would do that. I don't know. It's like a shakedown. Anyway, let's move on into the domestic tranquility file. We'll come back over from the turmoil, bloodshed, and unease that is circulating throughout Asia and the Middle East and the rest of the world as they're all in chaos here in the United States. We'll go to San Jose, California from CBS Television. An unidentified man was shot in the head execution style in front of a horrified lunchtime crowd at a McDonald's in San Jose. It appeared that the shooter walked up to the victim and shot him once at close range. So that's an afternoon with the family at McDonald's in a average suburban city here in America as all of civilization appears to careen out of control. And what is the source of all the violence and bloodshed here in the United States of America, folks? Well, let's go to a story. This is a blog from some skank. I don't know who she is. This is from AlertNet blog. I don't know who this person is, but it's one of these typical blogs. It's about the issue of personhood. Is an unborn child in his mother's womb, is it a person? Well, a lot of people are threatened by the assertion that indeed it is a person, and it should be respected as a person, and should have certain rights. Let's just give them one right, the right to life. We can get to other rights after they're born and learn to talk and stuff. But the one right, I think, we should grant to all persons, no matter how small, no matter how defenseless, no matter how weak, no matter how inconvenient, is the right to life. I mean, after all, someone extended that protection to us at one time. You'd think we'd be good enough to return the favor, but not this particular blogger, whose name I didn't write down because I just don't care. She says, women are being assaulted by attempts to establish fetal rights. Last month, legislators in South Dakota introduced a bill that was worded in such a way that it could allow for the legalized murder of abortion providers. Under a firestorm of controversy, the bill was withdrawn, but similar bills have also been introduced in Nebraska and in Iowa. And in South Dakota, there's a bill, along with a broader one there in Nebraska and Iowa, that would work to both subtly encourage terrorism and establish a potential defense for those who kill abortion doctors. Well, let me just say to this blogger that should personhood be reestablished in one of the several states, there'll be no need to kill abortionists because abortion would be illegal and we could arrest abortionists and we could put them on trial. And then the government could execute them in a fine, judicious, and painful manner, just like they should do with other murderers. So there's one red herring, straw man, whatever you want to call it, out the window. Let's continue with this particular skank's rantings. She says, women, especially pregnant women, are being assaulted rather than protected by attempts to establish fetal rights. Proponents of these, quote, personhood, unquote, laws admit that they are laying the groundwork for abortion bans, but still promote the laws as somehow being pro-woman. Excuse me, young lady. We don't want to lay the groundwork for abortion bans. We want to institute immediate abortion bans. Institute immediate criminal penalties for those doctors who would take advantage of typically scared and confused young women and kill their babies for money. Typically under the duress of a man, the man who impregnated them, who typically forces these women to have abortions. And if you don't think I'm right, well, you just obviously don't have any common sense. And you haven't talked with women who have either had abortions or changed their minds about having abortions. Because that's what it is, folks. And I know because I've been there. And I've talked to them. What is this raving lunatic? What else does she have to say? Oh, so she says these laws are being somehow promoted as pro-woman, but she says Planned Parenthood disagrees. They argue that women who miscarry or suffer pregnancy complications will find themselves turned over to the police for criminal misconduct. Well, of course that's what Planned Parenthood would say. They kill babies for money. That's their industry. They don't want to see their industry threatened, and they'll introduce all manner of lies and misconceptions to muddy the issue. But folks, just ask yourself in your heart, whether you're a Christian or you're just an average run-of-the-mill Joe who doesn't care, you're an agnostic, maybe you're an atheist, maybe you're a full-fledged garden variety sodomite freak of nature pervert, but you're listening to The Worldview for some reason, just ask yourself this. What is it inside a woman when she's pregnant? What is it? Be honest with yourself. Don't lie to yourself. Just ask yourself, what is it? Come on. It pains me to know that at such an advanced state of civilization, that this question is debated and successfully. The argument is won by the other side who kills babies, that this is not a person. If it's not a person, what is it? Folks, the reason the world is shaking, the reason that the polity, the global polity, is imploding upon itself is because of America. It's because America is not just broke. America's not just broke. America is bankrupt. And if you wonder what is the keystone that holds the whole world, that stops the whole world from devolving into an unending massacre, it is America. And if you look a little deeper, it is the Christian church in America. And the government of America may be broke, but the Christian church in America is bankrupt. And in going bankrupt, they have robbed the rest of the world of any chance for lasting peace and prosperity. And it is sad to watch it happen in my lifetime. It pains me to see it happen. I want to strike out and do something for the good. And it's going to be a big job, folks. But we're all up to the task, right? I'm talking to the Christians now. Are we going to stop these poor, savage heathens from butchering one another and lying to one another and stealing from one another and killing their own children? Are we going to stop them? Are we going to allow these poor slobs to squander it all in a generation? Ask yourself that question when you look in the mirror and when you go to church on Sunday. Look up at your pastor and ask, is he bankrupting the church or is he building the church up for the battle to come? Because there is a battle to come. It's going on right now. But it's going to hit a lot closer to home here in the next few months and years. And it is the church that is the last hope of civilization. It is not the government of America. It is not the administration of Barack Obama. It is not the court of Nicolas Sarkozy. It is the American Christian church, the confessing church, the remnant that is left. I hope you're with me. All right. Let me get down off my soapbox, and we'll go to the justice file. Do I want to go to the justice file? It's always so depressing. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Drug Enforcement Administration spokesman says, he wouldn't say why Georgia's supply of sodium thiopental was taken last Tuesday. He just said that we had questions about how the drug was imported to the U.S. Sodium thiopental, you'll remember, is the execution drug I think it gives the murderer a warm fuzzy right before he drifts off into sleep and passes over to the other side, at which point he's grabbed by the throat by the living God, and his gentle trip into la-la land is disrupted by Judgment Day. But sodium thiopental is that drug, and it's been confiscated there in Georgia, halting all executions. The sedative, according to the Associated Press, is part of the three-drug cocktail, yada, 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 that does it. Makes it really nice. I think you get a really good buzz before you die. That's how they do it now. Anyway, no more execution dates in Georgia have been scheduled, and it's unlikely any will be set before the issue is resolved. Apparently, Georgia's stockpile of the drug has been a target of death row inmates and capital punishment critics since correction officials released documents this year showing that the state obtained the drug from a British firm. The drug was used in January to execute Emmanuel Hammond, a 45-year-old man convicted for the 1988 shotgun slaying of an Atlanta preschool teacher. His attorney sought a delay to gather more information on how the state obtained the drug, claiming in court documents that it came from a, quote, fly-by-night supplier, that this British drug firm, Archimedes Pharma Limited. They say it's a fly-by-night supplier. So here, this is where we are in America, folks. We're willing to attack a pharmaceutical company that supplies drugs for our executions, yet we're willing to state the phrase medical marijuana with a straight face. And we're willing to call pot dealers in Montana and East Colfax in Denver and half a Broadway in Denver. We're willing to call them distributors of medicine while we question the source of sodium thiopental to execute murderers who've been on death row since right after I got out of high school. Feel like I'm watching. I am Doug McBurney. This is the Weekly Worldview, and we are rounding third and heading for home. Put those toys away, boys. It's time to get back to the show. Let's go to the culture file. I've got a story. Did I finish that last point about the marijuana and the thing? Yeah, I think I did. I think I did all right. Okay. Let's go to Baltimore from WJZ in Baltimore. WJZ's media partner, the Baltimore Sun, reports that Tilghman Elementary School has been holding prayer services for the past 2 years ahead of standardized testing. And the audience, a collective, no! That's right. Right before the big test there at the elementary school, the teachers have been having the kids pray. And needless to say, the American Civil Liberties Union is crying foul for having any organized prayer in the public school. And I disagree with the American Civil Liberties Union on everything, but I almost agree with them here, because I mean, would it really be appropriate to have organized prayer in a house of prostitution, or in a shooting gallery or a crack house? I mean, is it any more appropriate to have prayer to God in a public school that not only does not acknowledge his existence, but actively solicits young children and young minds away from his existence? It would seem to me that God would particularly detest prayers that were uttered from the temple of Baal. And like that. All right, so you know my opinion on the public schools. I don't have to get into that again. Let's go to San Francisco. More from the culture file from CBS. San Francisco police officers have started enforcing the city's new ban on sitting and lying on the sidewalk. It's another sign of the times, so to speak. San Francisco is so screwed up they have to pass a law that you can't sit or lie down on their sidewalks. Now, here where I live in the suburbs of Denver, you can go and sit or lie on the sidewalk. And the police generally won't arrest you. They probably stop and ask if you were okay. But in San Francisco, where they've let the bums take over certain districts in the city, instead of using some common sense and creating an atmosphere and an environment in which people are not allowed to be bums and urinate and defecate on the sidewalks, they've decided to pass a ban on sitting or lying on the sidewalk, which, folks, this is out of the Haight-Ashbury district, and a lot of folks in the Haight, they need to sit or lie down quite often, even during the middle of the day. If you're living in the Haight. In November, according to CBS, voters approved the sit-lie law, which makes it illegal to hang out on San Francisco's sidewalks between 7 a.m. and 11 p.m., which is when most of the people in the Haight are high as a kite, and they need it. They need a break. They need to sit down. Finally, after a few months of training, this according to CBS, after a few months of training, police officers are starting to enforce the new sit-lie law, giving verbal or written warnings for now. So this is government bureaucracy. This is the way it works. They tell the police there's a new law. People are not allowed to sit or lie down, and it takes a few months to train the police how to enforce that. Now, me, I think you could take an average troop of Boy Scouts and in about 15 minutes teach them how to enforce a no-sit-lie law. They'd probably look at you askew and wonder why you are insane and ask, why do you let these bums gather here all the time? But anyway, I'm just saying, okay? It takes several months to train bureaucrats to enforce anything. One hippie scumbag loser named Steve has been sitting on Hate Street sidewalks for 40 years, and he got his first warning on Tuesday. He said, quote, the cops said that the first time we get admonished, and then after that, they'll start filling out tickets. Ticket, yeah, I hope it's to a Fish concert, dude. Anyway, so the cops are going to issue tickets to penniless homeless people in the streets. And it took 3 months to train them how to do that. One bar owner in the area said he hasn't noticed an impact yet, but he hopes the law will help police clean up the hate. I just find that ironic. In San Francisco, there's a district called the Hate, and it's not filled with love. It's filled with hate and degeneracy and deviancy and drugs and scum and filth and urine and feces and everything else that you would associate with the hippie lifestyle in San Francisco is right there in the Hate. This bar owner said, quote, businesses there in the Hate really have a hard time. People don't want to walk over people who are peeing on the street. The whole thing is a disaster there. More from CBS. Officers who are patrolling the beat said for now they will direct people to city services and not hand out any tickets. Well, I'm sure that'll help the situation. Excuse me, sir. Could you hold off on urinating there for a second? Let me take you. I'll drive you to the station. Let me drive you down to the station. You can use our bathroom, take a shower, and then we'll deposit you back in the street where you can continue to squander your pathetic life. Instead of arresting these bums, trying them for being bums, and you just can't allow bums to gather on the streets. A good caning, I would say, is in order. And a second and a third offense, well, the canings get stronger and stronger, and don't push me any further, Mr. Bum. Go get a job. You don't want to find out what a fourth offense gets you. All right. More from the culture file. We go from the Hate to the University of Chicago, prestigious University of Chicago. A group of University of Chicago students have created a website called UChicagoHookups.com. The site offers students a chance to hook up with other students for casual encounters. Now, for those of you who are of my age group and older, you know that in the past, you used to hook up with people all the time. You'd call your buddy on the phone. Yeah, I got the guns. I got the targets, man. Let's hook up down at the shooting pit. We'll go shoot some beer cans, shoot some targets. We'll go hook up. Well, that's not what hook up means anymore, especially at the University of Chicago. It means promiscuity. It means fornication, basically. And so they've set up a website where students can encounter one another in a casual manner. The site advertises, quote, chastity is curable if detected early, unquote. At which point, all of the viewers of Two and a Half Men laughed and chuckled and slapped their knee. Folks, chastity is curable if detected early? Let me meet one of these bastards in the presence of my daughter, and I will physically throttle him. That's what these punks need. You want to set up a website that says that, young man? I'm going to jerk you up by your stacking swivel and teach you a lesson, young man. But it's not just the men, folks. That's the problem. Listen to this. Kimberly Wright, a student there, female student, she says, quote, I think it's a good idea. It's lots of fun. She says, I haven't used it, but I have friends who have. Yeah. You're just holding that joint for a friend. Anyway. That's the state of higher education, folks. If you turn your children over to the government schools, whether at the elementary, grade school, high school, college level, you're sinning against God and you're sinning against your child. You should be ashamed of yourself sending your daughters into the belly of the beast there at any one of our state universities. Anyway, all right, let's move. I had to wait for the blood to clear out of my face there. Quite upset there. All right. Let's go more to the culture file. This is from the Reuters Wire from jolly old England. A survey of 2,000 British adults in steady relationships pinpointed the 36-month marker as the time when relationship stress levels peak and points to a new trend of solo holidays away from partners and spouses that many Britons resort to in order to keep the romance alive. So basically, after about 3 years, the people married in Britain, you know, they used to call it the 7-year itch. Now they call it the 3-year glitch. And they basically start cheating on each other, contracting venereal diseases, and in short order, they're divorced. And their children's lives are ruined, if there are any children. I don't know if anyone in Britain has any children anymore. Anyway, the findings show that 67% of all those surveyed said that small irritations, which are seemingly harmless and often endearing during the first flushes of love, often expand into major irritations around 36 months into a, quote, committed relationship. So we're not even talking about marriage here, folks. We're just talking about people who shack up. They can't even manage to shack up for 36 months without end up hating each other. And then if they get married, well, I'm sure it's even worse over there. That they just can't relate to the marriage commitment anymore. The study suggests that as we get older together, romance gives way to day-to-day practicalities. Wow. Astonishing. How about that? The first flushes of love and romance and that warm, fuzzy feeling and that weakness in the knees, after a while, you start realizing that, hey, marriage is not about that. Life isn't about that. Life isn't about being giddy all the time. I mean, unless you live in the hate. You're dropping acid every afternoon. Marriage is not just about being happy. Marriage is about helping each other survive and live and thrive. It's about having children. It's about responsibility. And it's about the day-to-day grind and learning how to live with another person who's imperfect, just like you are. Hard to live with. Hard to take. It's about learning how to love someone. And love is not about romance and gushing and pretty and sex and all. That's not what love is. Love is about learning how to find contentment in yourself and in another fallen human being. And I'm convinced that the most effective way to find that is there has to be an objective standard. It can't be the husband and it can't be the wife because they're both flawed human beings. But if you have a third person involved in the relationship, Jesus Christ, who is the standard, well, then you have an objective standard against which both of you can send out soundings and improve yourselves. But if you're looking to be happy all the time, I mean, yeah, 3 years is about it before you realize, all right, I got all these other stories I want to do, but I just don't have time. All right, let's go from the culture file, from the Washington Times. America's self-described toughest sheriff, Joe Arpaio in Arizona, has issued a warning to the CEO of Craigslist, saying the popular internet website is providing, quote, a mechanism to facilitate criminal activity, unquote. Sheriff Joe Arpaio's warning to Jim Buckmaster follows the arrest last month in Arizona by Maricopa County Sheriff's Office detectives of two men, one a middle school teacher and the other a handyman, on charges of conspiracy to commit bestiality. Oh, man, that's disgusting. I had to throw that paper out of my... That's unbelievable. Sheriff Arpaio... Oh, by the way, bestiality may or may not be illegal in your state, but Sheriff Arpaio was instrumental in making the offense a crime in Arizona in 2006. So, folks, bestiality was such a freak thing outside the realm of any normalcy that most states didn't even have laws on the books against it because it was just unheard of. I mean, you talk about... Anyway, so Sheriff Joe's now got to fight Craigslist and... All right. One more story from Der Spiegel in Germany. Before undergoing a sex change to become a woman, Monika Straub was a member of Germany's neo-Nazi party. But now, 10 years later, she's running for the state parliament as a member of the Socialist Left Party. That's right. Today, the 35-year-old nurse and photographer is named Monika Straub, and she's campaigning for the Socialist Left Party. Straub told reporters that she's now the victim of far-right harassment now that she's become a boy. No, wait a minute. It was a boy who became a girl. I'm sorry, I don't want to confuse you. Christopher Koppel, a spokesman for the Socialist Left Party in Germany, described the Straub's history with the Nazi Party as a youthful transgression and said that she has, quote, fundamentally changed, unquote. A fundamental transformation indeed. From a masculine Nazi to a rather feminine socialist. Actually, I don't think there's much of a change there. But it is definitely a fundamental transformation. Folks, my name is Doug McBurney. That's been the Weekly Worldview. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, I want to thank my friends at KGOV and American Right to Life. And Colorado Right to Life. And of course, my other brother, Darryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.